That's the end of the first half. As the teams head to the locker room, the Spartans lead the Bulldogs by a score.
You guys stink.
Jeez, Coach, we're only down a couple of points.
No, I mean you guys really smell. You need to hit the showers. And here, I got every one of you new bars of soap from the Sterling Soap Company. Each bar is artisan crafted using natural ingredients and essential oils. They also have shave soaps, colognes, beard balm, and a whole lot more. Now get in there.
But Coach, we have another half to play.
I don't care. I can't stand to be around you.
A few minutes later.
All right, bring it in tight. You guys are still playing terrible, but you're smelling great out there. Now listen, you're going to need to stock up for the rest of the season. We got a lot of tough games left. So go to sterlingsoap.com after the game. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com. You got that?
Yes, Coach.
Great. sterlingsoap.com on three. One, two, three.
sterlingsoap.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, old sports, and welcome to another episode of the Hello, Old Sports podcast on the Sports History Network. I'm Dan Newman. I'm joined, as always, by my brother, Andrew Newman, and we are very excited for tonight because we have another author interview on tap, and we're really excited about that. And I will introduce our guest in just a second here. But before that, Andrew, how are you doing tonight?
I am doing well, Dan. Any chance to, I think as I said to you, I was at a barbecue over Labor Day weekend, and I texted you and I said, how come nobody ever wants to talk about anything normal like the 1905 World Series? So this is we're a few decades past that, but it's still generally in the same ballpark. So we are very much in my wheelhouse and I'm excited.
All right. And we are joined here by Tom Wolfe, who is the author of The Called Shot, Babe Ruth, the Chicago Cubs, and the unforgettable Major League Baseball season of 1932, which was a finalist for the Seymour Medal from Sabre. He's also the co-author with Patricia Bryan of Midnight Assassin, A Murder in America's Heartland. But he is here to talk to us tonight about his new book, which just came out very recently, Baseball in the Roaring Twenties, The Yankees, the Cardinals, and the Captivating 1926 Season. Tom, thanks so much for joining us tonight here on Hello Old Sports.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm looking forward to this.
So Andrew and I both read the book, and we were talking a little bit before about how I also 4 or 5 years ago read the Called Shot book and absolutely loved that book. Sort of for a fan of, you know, the Yankees of the Babe Ruth era, you couldn't pick probably two better or more interesting seasons in 26 or 32. But just kind of tell us a little bit about the book and what you discuss in it.
Well, the book is focused mainly on the 1926 baseball season and focused on the white major leagues, although it does have I do have a couple of chapters on black baseball. This idea for the book really comes from my research into the 1932 season, which you've mentioned, you know, was the subject for the book, The Called Shot. Because when I worked on the Called Shot, I spent a lot of time researching the major players in that season. Babe Ruth, of course, being the major New York Yankee player. But the other major player in 1932 was major figure in the pennant race was Rogers Hornsby, who was the manager of the Cubs. And the Cubs wound up getting to the World Series, but they did it without Hornsby because he got fired in August in the midst of a pennant race. So I had that idea, you know, the Ruth Hornsby kind of connection. We played in different leagues, but they were the best right-handed and best left-handed hitters of their generation, big stars for their individual teams, but they didn't really collide career-wise until 1926. And so that's what really attracted me at the beginning to write about and research 1926 was what I could say about the relationship between Ruth and Hornsby and how they came to that World Series really from different places in terms of where the teams were and where they were as players.
Go ahead, Andrew.
I was just going to say it's also, you know, in a lot of ways we trace the beginning of sort of the Yankee era, the dominant American League team of the 20th century to, you know, 1920, 1921 when Babe Ruth comes in. this is really the start of the Cardinals arc, who, you know, the Dodgers may have something to say about it, but really the dominant National League team of the entire rest of the 20th century. And, you know, they were kind of a non-factor the first two decades, and this being their first championship season, first time they even got to a World Series, it's sort of the starting point for that sort of right as McGraw's Giants are leaving center stage. They won the pennant 4 years in a row and now are, 21 through 24, they'd won. And then, so sort of as they're fading into the background, you have this Cardinals team that these 20s teams would give way to the Gas House Gang, would give way to the early 40s teams, and really not stop until, you know, the 80s or whatever, with some lulls here and there. So it's sort of an interesting season from that standpoint as well.
Yeah, and it's really true for both franchises, because the Yankees had only won one World Series by 1926. As you say, their dominance in the American League began in a way in 1920 when Ruth came over, but they didn't win. They only won the one World Series in 1923, whereas the Cardinals, as you say, hadn't even won a National League pennant or gotten to a World Series. But from 26 to 46, 21 years, 15 of those 21 years, the world championship was won by either the Cardinals or the Yankees. They dominated their leagues and really dominated baseball for two decades.
So maybe we'll kind of start with the Cardinals, because, you know, Yankees Babe Ruth is something that a lot of people are probably familiar with. But the way I kind of look at it is there's sort of three key figures on this Cardinal team, and maybe just kind of ask you to say a little bit about each one of them. The first one is Hornsby. So, as an introduction, who is Rogers Hornsby? What role does he play in the Cardinals? And what do we need to know about him, both as a player and as a manager?
As a player, he came up to the Cardinals in around 1914, I believe. The manager then was Miller Huggins, who ironically later became the manager of the Yankees and managed against Hornsby's team in the 26 World Series. But Hornsby was an outstanding batter, right-handed hitter. He hit over 400 three times. And going into the 1925 season, starting in 1925, he was playing for Branch Rickey, who was the manager of the Cardinals that year. And the Cardinals got off to a really terrible start. Hornsby was 29 years old. He'd been in the league about 10 years. And the Cardinals made a change. They fired Rickey, moved him up to the front office, and hired Hornsby at 29 to be the player manager. And he led them from basically seventh place to fourth place. So that going into the 1926 season, you had Hornsby as the player manager, 30 years old. He hit .403 in 1925, 39 home runs, 143 runs batted in. He had just the dominance year going into 1926, which would be his first full-time, fully season gig as a manager.
And then I think the second person that I kind of wanted to ask you about, and you alluded to him already, everybody knows the name Branch Rickey as the guy who integrated the Dodgers in 1947 or 46, I guess, actually brought Jackie Robinson into the major leagues. But he spent more time in his career with the Cardinals, a lot more, in fact. So where is Branch Rickey in the arc of his career in 1926?
Well, in 1926, he's kind of been kicked upstairs. You know, he's had his career as a player, his career as a manager. In 1920, he actually came up with the idea and instituted the farm system, where he began to recruit and sign players to play in the minor leagues as a way of sort of bringing them up to the major leagues. So prior to 1926, he had been in baseball really all his adult life, and was an innovator and was really respected as a sort of a baseball intellectual, but he was not particularly successful as a manager. And so in 1926, he was moving up into managerial and executive positions from his previous role as a manager. And he and Hornsby didn't really get along. I will note that. But on the other hand, you know, Hornsby basically irritated every manager he played for and every owner he played for. So I imagine that they would have had a clash just because of their different personalities. But Hornsby clashed in one way or another with virtually everybody, except John McGraw, who you've mentioned earlier. He and John McGraw got along. They both were sort of rascals in a way, and great personalities.
Yeah, and they ended up, McGraw ends up managing Hornsby for one season in 1927, and we'll get to that in a second. And before I turn it over to Andrew, then the third guy who I think we all need to know about doesn't join the Cardinals till midseason, but ends up playing a major role is Grover Cleveland Alexander.
Right, and I would pair Alexander as a significant part of that team with Billy Southworth, mm-hmm. who got traded actually to the Cardinals or at about the same time that Alexander was. Hornsby, going into the season, thought he had a decent team, but he needed another starting pitcher, and he wanted a better hitting outfielder. And he got Southworth from the Giants for Heinie Mueller. And then Southworth had his best year of his career with the Cardinals in 26. But the real star and the real acquisition that made a difference for the Cardinals, not only in the season, but especially in the World Series, was Grover Cleveland Alexander, who the Cubs had kind of given up on at age 39. Alexander was known to have a drinking problem. He didn't take care of his body. He had his own way of kind of getting ready for games. He liked to smoke a cigarette and, you know, didn't like to run between games. I mean, he did things his own way. But by the time he got to the Cardinals in 1926, he was traded from the Cubs. He'd already won 330 games. I mean, he was an established star. And Hornsby, and I think I give Hornsby a great deal of credit for this as a manager in terms of understanding what Alexander was capable of and how he could manage Alexander, although they're very different personalities. Hornsby really wanted Alexander and relied on him throughout the rest of the season, and especially again in the World Series. And I've got a whole chapter on Alexander in the book because he is such a dominant and important figure, not only in baseball history, but certainly for the Cardinals and this season.
And he'd been, he's in his, what, he's like 38 or something along those lines in this season, you know, 39.
And given the way he took care of his body was probably a 50-year-old, you know, but
like, it was a 50-year-old in 1926, which for now, yeah. You know, nowadays is an 80-year-old. But so I just wanted to switch a little to the Yankees. And I think, first of all, I really appreciated the a lot of people, when they talk about the history of the Yankees, it's sort of like, oh, they came in 1903. They were really good in 1904 with Jack Chesbrough. Then nothing happened until Babe Ruth. And, you know, sort of you explaining the different ownership and how Huggins came to manage them was very, I think, enlightening for people who might not be familiar with the story. With regards to Ruth, because it's funny, my brother and I have joked about this before. Every couple of years, it seemed like there was Ruth would have a bad year. Everybody would talk about how his career was over. You know, 1922, it happened. I think his last year with Boston in 1918 or 1919. 25 was a really down year for Babe Ruth. And going into 1926, the smart money was sort of on the Yankees thing being done. Isn't that correct?
That's absolutely correct. I mean, sports writers wrote them off. I mean, they finished 28 and a half games out of first place in 25. the only team that was worse were the Red Sox, who were really, really terrible in 25. So not only were the Yankees not a very good team by, you know, on paper at the end of 1925, there is no reason for people to think that Ruth was going to bounce back at age 31, you know, given the way he trained and what people knew about his off the field activities. Plus the 1925 season was so terrible for Ruth. I mean, he missed a bunch of games. He hit 290, you know, mentioned earlier, Hornsby hit 403, you know, there's a comparison. 403 versus 290. In terms of home runs, Ruth hit 25. Hornsby had hit 39. Ruth had 66 RBIs that year. Hornsby had 143. I mean, you couldn't have two careers going in much opposite, you know, much more dramatically opposite directions. And the Yankees also, they were, you know, they were going to have to make some changes in terms of their roster. So going into 26, they had Earl Combs in center field. He was a second year player. Gehrig was a second year player. And the Yankees were using rookies at shortstop and second base, Mark Koenig and Tony Lazzari. So the roster was being kind of revamped and pretty much untested going into 26. So you can understand how sports writers and fans thought the Yankees at best might be, you know, a fourth or fifth place team.
And ironically, it was, you know, it was the Washington Senators who were considered sort of the powerhouse in the American League for really the first and only time ever they'd won the previous two pennants. And, you know, the names you mentioned, Lazzari, Koenig, Combs, we know them now as what made up Murderer's Row. But at the time, they were unproven first and second year players, and Ruth was considered to be over the hill.
Right.
Yeah.
And Gehrig, right? Gehrig was not really Gehrig yet. Gehrig was only in the streak started in 25. He'd had a cup of coffee in 24, but he really wasn't, you know, he was really going into his second major league season. And I think full major league season. And I think you write in the book that Gehrig almost gets traded to St. Louis for Urban Shocker.
Right. Well, they wanted to get Urban Shocker back. Cause he had been a Yankee. They traded him to the Browns. And then in terms of trying to get Shocker back, the Yankees had some, you know, as we're saying, some young players to trade. And, you know, Gehrig was a huge man. And I think people recognized that he might become a really good power hitter, but he hadn't shown that yet. And so he was somebody who was considered tradable. It's just that the Browns didn't need another first baseman. So the Yankees wound up keeping him. And then getting Urban Shocker also for lesser players.
Yeah, and Shocker is another guy with a really sort of interesting but tragic story. Maybe tell us a little bit about him, too.
Yeah, he had a heart condition that people didn't recognize, probably mitral valve problem that was not treated at all. And he died, I believe, at 38 or 39. He continued to play baseball, you know, right up to the end. But he was very sickly. He couldn't sleep lying down. He had to sleep sitting up. But he was a pretty durable, tough pitcher on the mound and had a really good career. He had good years with the St. Louis Browns before he came back to the Yankees.
Pitches all of 26, starts 32 games. So basically answers the bell every time it's his turn and then starts two games in the World Series. And then the following year, in 27, again, pitches the whole season, but then he's too ill to appear in the World Series, tries to come back in 28, but he's not up to it. He only really pitches one game for two innings and then is dead by the end of the 1928 season. Even within the box of 27, 28 Yankees pitchers, you got a couple Hall of Famers like Hoyt and Pennock and some of those guys. Urban Shocker, because of his premature death and because he never actually appears in any of the only World Series appearances in 26. So he kind of gets forgotten in history. He's not in the Hall of Fame. He's not as well known even as some of those guys.
Yeah. Yeah. And as you say, a really tragic figure. And I suppose the early death and the fact that he didn't have any long career after baseball is one reason people have sort of forgotten about him.
You know, it's funny how the Yankees of this period, there really are a lot of sort of young or youngish premature deaths. I mean, Lazzari dies very young after an epileptic seizure. Lou Gehrig obviously dies young. Ruth is in his early 50s, but even he dies young. We talked about Urban Shocker. So there really is sort of a lot of premature death on these mid-20s Yankees teams.
Yeah, and Miller Huggins.
And Miller Huggins, you know, too, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, when my wife was reading that, you know, the manuscript, and she got to the epilogue, she made that comment. She said, as she was going through the epilogue where I talk about what happened to various players, she said, all these players on the Yankees, you know, they're all dead by the time they're 50. Yeah. You know, yeah, Ruth lived to 53, which seemed like he was kind of like an old man compared to some of the others.
Yeah.
And who knows, was that luck? Was it just medicine at that time? I mean, Shocker, if he had that same heart condition today, probably would have survived into his 80s. I mean, it's very treatable now, not so treatable or even known at that time.
I remember reading something, not, you know, we're obviously talking about like heart illness, you know, heart disease and things that kill people. But I remember reading, I think it was a book about the 23 season, and they talked about something, you know, we think of players as being tougher than, guys would miss time with infections that these days a cream or a spray would clear up in 3 days. But then back then that was a 2 or 3 month injury because there was really no way to treat it because they didn't really even know what it was, you know? So it's just, it was such a different world that's, you know, it was tough in general, but then in the context of being a professional athlete is just that much harder.
Right. Right. And you think even of Hornsby, I mean, Hornsby had bone spurs in his foot, you know, you would think that, you know, in his late 20s, early 30s, given what he was capable of doing as an athlete, that if he had today's medicine, he would have had a lot more games that he could have played. And,
Dan, I know we're going to probably want to end with the World Series, but I think we want to probably also, before we get there, talk about both the season in black baseball and also the Dutch Leonard story. We talk about the Negro League season and black baseball at large.
Well, before we do that, maybe one more thing, then we'll get to black baseball. You devote a whole chapter to the relationship between Ruth and Cobb, which is really has always been a fascinating and very interesting chapter of baseball history. What made you feel like you need to include that?
Yeah, that's interesting because that's a chapter I really debated, first of all, writing, and then after writing it, keeping, because I wasn't sure it exactly fit into the narrative, you know, of the story. Cobb, of course, is significant when we get to the Cobb speaker, you know, big betting game fixing allegations. So, and Cobb was certainly of the older players, of the early generation players, you know, a significant figure in baseball history. I included the chapter finally, just because I thought it illustrated what a unique person Cobb was. And I think Cobb even today, I think is hard to understand. I mean, there've been two pretty good biographies written of him. But Cobb and Ruth really were different generations. They represented different generations. They represented different ways of playing the game. I think fans related to the game differently in Cobb's era than it did in Ruth's era. So they were just kind of diametrically opposed in certain ways. And Cobb had that one really great game in Yankee Stadium, which was the last time he played in Yankee Stadium. And I thought, well, that's a really dramatic moment. And it's one of the few places in the book, other than the World Series, where I wanted to stop and describe a single game. Mm-hmm. Because for the most part, most of the single season books I've read, and many of which I admire, have a lot of individual games sort of along the season. And I didn't want to do that so much with this book because I wanted to include more about the culture of the 1920s and sort of the environment that the games were played. But I thought with the Ruth and Cobb chapter that gave me a chance to kind of illustrate the changing of the guard, even though it was Cobb's game to win in Yankee Stadium. So I'm glad you liked that, because that was one part of the book that I was nervous about whether or not I should keep it or not in the book.
Yeah. I just have always thought, and we haven't done an episode on him yet, although we keep threatening to, and we will soon. Cobb is just one of the most infinitely fascinating figures in Major League Baseball. Even if you sort of take away some of the controversy surrounding him, and then sort of what's been kind of a correction to maybe some of the controversy with some of the biographies that you mentioned, just on the field. I mean, the way the guy dominated on the field for so long, and even in this chapter where you have the Ruth versus Cobb, I wrote Cobb is still an elite player despite his age and the changes in the game. And that's when you reference Cobb going 438 with two home runs in a series against the Yankees. So in this 1926, in his first year, his final year as a Tiger, when he's playing and managing, I guess he must be hurt or something this year, because he only plays in 79 games, but the guy still hits 339 on the season. And then when he moves on to Philadelphia, he hits 357 the following year. So to his very last days in baseball, when he's already north of 40, Ty Cobb is one of the best players in the league.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it goes to the way he handled the bat. I mean, he had a style of hitting it kind of went out of favor once Ruth began hitting home runs with such, you know, so frequently. And I was just thinking recently, actually, it was this summer, thinking about the Hall of Fame inductions this summer, that the modern player who reminds me in certain ways as a hitter of like Ty Cobb is Ichiro.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, a player who could handle the bat, could hit home runs if he wanted to, and was going to get you 200 hits every season, and could play into his 40s. And I mean, there haven't been many players since Cobb who had anything close to Cobb's skill set. And that makes him sort of, as you say, sort of a figure not only to admire, but to kind of wonder about, because he's so unique. I mean, he would be a great subject for one of your shows. I don't know if the author of that most recent Cobb biography does interviews, but that's a really good Cobb biography, I think.
That's the Charles Learson one. That is really, I think we've both read that. I think I actually bought that for Andrew for his birthday one year, actually.
Yeah, well, it's just Cobb too often gets reduced to a cartoon character. Whatever story somebody's trying to tell, if they're trying to talk about, you know, the racial history of baseball, which is obviously a worthy story, he gets short of, he's the shorthand for how racist baseball was before 1947. If they're trying to talk about the era, he's the guy who got into a fist fight in every game and stabbed guys with his cleats. And it's like, there's enough, you paint over so much of the interesting actual story to tell, you know, a fairy tale, basically. And that's my frustration in general.
And I've said this on the podcast before, but, you know, Babe Ruth once, held Miller Huggins off the back of a moving train because he was angry at him. Babe Ruth went into the stands to punch a fan. Babe Ruth punched umpires. In fact, Babe Ruth punched, and you both probably know this, and I think it was Ernie Shore was the pitcher for Boston. There was a game in the teens when Babe Ruth was on Boston, walked the first batter as a pitcher. Babe Ruth punched the umpire after being called for a walk. Ernie Shore comes in to pitch. They throw the guy out stealing, and then Ernie Shore gets the next 26 outs for basically a perfect game.
Right.
But if Ty Cobb had punched umpires and held his manager off a train and got into the stands, which, I mean, Ty Cobb did do some of those things, but it would be painted in such a different light, whereas with Ruth, it's just kind of this jolly fat man who loved life so much. So it's just,
oh, he was having fun.
Yeah, he was having fun.
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting. That's a really interesting observation. Yeah, very, very true. And I, it's just, you know, again, I think that you've made sort of the point about Cobb also being, the poster boy in a way for segregation in baseball, or the bigotry in baseball. And I think, you know, considering how many players grew up in the South and had associations with the Klan, you know, that's really unfair to have Cobb be so featured in that discussion. Truth Speaker, on the other hand, probably was a member of the KKK. He grew up in West Texas, where all adult white males were members of the KKK.
Yeah. And and I mean, I'm a huge Ken Burns fan, don't get me wrong, but, and, you know, and I love, you know, I can't wait till what's his next documentary is The American Revolution. It comes out in 2 months. I'm already counting down the week. So I love Ken Burns. I love everything he does. But, and I think Ken Burns even said this, but it was very clear to, he said this, I think, that they needed somebody to juxtapose with Jackie Robinson, and they chose Ty Cobb in their baseball documentary and kind of painted him with a brush that was probably a little unfair.
Well, I mean, they're similar in terms of being intense competitors and base runners. You know, I mean, that's I'd never really thought of that combination or that juxtaposition, but I think that works well. And Ken Burns, as you have said, you know, he knows how to create a narrative, and that was the narrative. Yeah.
And ironically, it was Robinson who brought back a lot of the style of baseball that Ty Cobb loved to the major leagues.
Absolutely, yeah.
Why don't we
real quick? Should we talk a little about the Negro Leagues?
Why don't we do that next? But why don't we? Since we're already talking about Cobb, maybe let's talk a little bit about the scandal. So, it's Cobb's last year with the Tigers, and Tris Speaker his last year with Cleveland, and Tom, maybe you could Tell us why. What happens?
Well, the whole Speaker Cobb game fixing scandal or allegations goes back to a game played in September of 1919, 6 days before the end of the 1919 season. So it's 6 days also before the start of the Black Sox World Series, the White Sox and Reds, the series that was obviously fixed, where the White Sox lost on purpose, and you know, gamblers made some money. So it goes back to that era. In September of 1919, Cobb was manager of the Tigers, and he had a pitcher named Dutch Leonard. Now there are two Dutch Leonards in baseball history. This is the first of the two. The second one was a knuckleballer who pitched for the Senators back in the 40s and 50s, I believe. But this Dutch Leonard was an excellent left-handed pitcher. He pitched on that same Boston Red Sox pitching staff with Smokey Joe Wood and Ernie Shore and Babe Ruth. And that was a team that Tris Speaker was on. So Leonard had a connection to Speaker from the past and to Smokey Joe Wood, who becomes part of the story. But he was playing for the Tigers. He was one of Cobb's pitchers in 1919. Near the end of the season, the Cleveland Indians had clinched second place. The White Sox had clinched first place. The Tigers were battling with the Yankees for third place, which meant extra money coming out of the World Series pot if they could get to third place. Leonard pitched a game, and then the next to last game of the series, won 4-1. And after that game, Leonard alleges that under the stands, he met with Smokey Joe Wood, a Cleveland player, Tris Speaker, the Cleveland manager, and Ty Cobb. And Speaker said to them, "We are going to lose tomorrow, we being the Indians. So we might as well put some money on the game for the Tigers to win and make a little bit of money." According to Leonard, each of the players put up between $1,000 and $2,000 each, which is a lot of money when you consider what their salaries were. You know, close to 10% of their salaries, they were willing to bet on a single game because Speaker said the Indians are going to lose. The money was collected later, given to a Tigers field assistant, a guy who worked for the Tigers, who then tried to place the bet with bookies in Detroit, and the bookies in Detroit wouldn't take that much money. So he went to Chicago, where there were bookies who would take some of the money. This is all according to Leonard, of course. Mm-hmm. So the game was played the next day. It was the last game of the series. The Tigers did win. They won 9-5. There were 31 hits in the game.
Jeez.
Cobb's team was the team supposed to win, but Cobb only went 1-for-5, so he didn't really contribute much. Speaker's team was supposed to lose, but Speaker went 3-for-5 with 2 triples. He certainly didn't lay down. I mean, he was the leading hitter on his team. And the game itself, I think the most unique thing about the game is that it was played in 66 minutes.
Jeez.
So what kind of game was that? for the fans, there were very small attendance there. But if you came to a game and saw a 9-inning game, saw a lot of action, but you saw it in 66 minutes. I mean, that's like not that's the way
like,
baseball.
It's like 3 innings now. Yeah. Or at least before the pitch clock, that was like 3 innings.
Yeah.
Game right. Faster then, but not that fast.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Exactly.
Right. Well, the Indians, of course, had nothing to play for, and they were in Detroit, and they wanted to get back home. And one of the rationales for how fast the game was played is that the Indians, if they could play the game fast enough, they could take the train back to Cleveland. But if the game went too long, they'd have to take a boat, and then they would get back later. So there was some rationale, at least from the Indians players, just to get this game over with so we can get back home. So anyway, that's the allegation from Leonard. And shortly thereafter, Smokey Joe Wood wrote a letter to Leonard and included a check for his share of the money that had been bet. And Cobb wrote a letter to Dutch Leonard saying that he didn't really like that whole deal with the $2,000 and hoped he wasn't in that kind of a deal again. but he didn't get the money down, indicating that he didn't act, his 2000 never actually got to a bookie to be bet. So Leonard got these letters shortly after the season ended in 1919 and hung on to them for 7 years. So what prompted him in 1926 to bring these letters out to Ban Johnson, the president of the American League? Well, the year before, when Cobb was still playing Leonard was still playing for Ty Cobb in Detroit, Cobb had gotten so disgusted and with Leonard and disliked him. In fact, Cobb at one point said there were only two players that he hated enough to intentionally try to injure, and one of them was Dutch Leonard, who had been his pitcher for a number of years.
That's probably not the guy you want to be your manager, is the guy who right. says that you're one of the few people I would intentionally hurt.
That's right. So in the 1924, maybe 1925 season, Leonard was pitching well. I think he had a record of 14-11, and Cobb just got rid of him. He sold his contract to a team in the Pacific Coast League, banished him from baseball. He was on waivers, so Speaker could have picked him up. Speaker didn't pick him up. So Cobb was able to basically send Leonard out of baseball to the Pacific Coast League. Leonard refused to report and retired from the game at age 33, while still a pretty good pitcher. So Leonard had a chip on his shoulder. He had a grudge. He wanted to get back at Speaker and Cobb, and he felt he'd really been cheated out of a couple of years of salary by getting banished to the Pacific Coast League. So in 1926, he took these two letters that he'd saved for 7 years, took them to Chicago, wanted to give them to Ban Johnson, basically told Ban Johnson, the president of the American League, that he could sell them to the newspapers for $20,000. Ban Johnson decided to intercede and said, I'll buy the letters for $20,000. That gave Leonard the money that he thought he'd been cheated out of by missing two seasons. And it gave Ban Johnson some assurance that he was protecting the integrity of the American League. And he told nobody until September. In September, he informed the other presidents of the American League that he had these letters. There had been this allegation from Leonard that there was a fixed game that they bet on. And he thought that the American League presidents of the other teams would go along with what he had done, and that they would banish Cobb and Speaker. They would ask Cobb and Speaker to retire as a way of punishing them. The American League presidents decided instead that they had to report it to Judge Landis, and that kind of blew it up into a more public thing.
Especially because Landis and Johnson hated each other.
Right, and this gave Landis something to hold over Johnson. And Johnson at this point was he was suffering from diabetes and alcoholism and was not in very good health. And Landis was happy to stomp on him, basically.
And it's as much as these guys at this point didn't want gambling in their sport, they also didn't want stories about two of their highest profile players. The extent to which they didn't need this crap, basically, was their attitude. Like, what can we do to make sure these guys are punished, or that we're dealing with this, but also in a way that's private, you know, that doesn't make the newspapers and doesn't drag up, you know, the stories about the 1919 World Series and all of that. And sort of this delicate dance between all of them of how can we deal with this as quietly as possible, basically.
Right. That was the attitude, certainly of Ban Johnson, and what he hoped would be the attitude of the American League presidents. But once it got tossed into the lap of Judge Landis, it became very public.
And so they end up doing this weird thing where they both leave their managing jobs, and Cobb goes to Philadelphia for two seasons. Speaker goes, I believe, to Washington for a year and then to Philly. Something that was interesting in the book was that those two players were allowed to sign with any American League team that they wanted to, but they couldn't sign with a National League team. I don't know what the reason for that was, if there even was one, but that was sort of an interesting nugget from the book.
Well, yeah, I think it had to do, I think it goes back to the Ban Johnson Judge Landis feud, because mm-hmm. Ban Johnson said when he was kicking them out of the American League that they couldn't play in the American League. And so when Landis got the opportunity to make a decision. He said, you can only play in the American League, which I think was basically just another way to show Ben Johnson who was boss. Yeah, there's one of the, you know, in terms of the investigation that Landis did, I was always fascinated by the fact that he really thought he could get to the bottom of this somehow by interviewing Dutch Leonard. And he invited Leonard to come to Chicago to testify, and Leonard refused. And as you know from the book, he refused on the grounds that people get killed in Chicago. He wasn't going to come to Chicago in the middle of the 20s. And so Landis went to California to interview Leonard in California, interviewed him there, had the letters as evidence, and then brought Speaker Cobbs and Smokey Joe Wood to his office to interrogate them in front of the media. I mean, Landis made it as public as possible. This was in December when he finally got everybody together. And once again, I think there's a really an interesting question as to why Landis did what he did. My take on it is that he didn't want to punish these two icons of the game, thought the best thing for the integrity of the game was to drop it, was to just declare that it was not a fixed game. It was a game that players had bet on, which was ethically okay before 1920. And so Landis kind of massaged the issue a little bit to try to, I think, do what was best for baseball. He didn't want another scandal, just as you're saying, did not want another scandal that brought fans' attention to 1919. And since this game had been played in 1919, it was going to be linked in the media. I don't know. What do you guys have as a take on what Landis did? I mean, I'm really curious what you think of that.
I think I think at one point you even quote in the book him basically saying, like, why does all this stuff that happened before I was here still keep hanging over me? I think his reaction to those guys gambling that year or even in 1921 would have been very different than it was. It's almost like the 1919 World Series is sort of like the line of demarcation. Everything before then, whatever it was, is done as long as it stopped then. So he wasn't going to be seen to be soft on the issue, even though he kind of was. But he also wasn't going to banish Ty Cobb specifically for gambling based on something that may or may not have happened 7 years ago.
Right.
I've always kind of thought of it sort of like, this is a funny, I was listening to something the other day just to switch sports for a minute. Somebody was talking about, I think it was Jimmy Johnson when he was coaching the Cowboys. And it was like Michael Irvin could get away with coming in, you know, hungover and not ready for practice. But the fifth receiver on the team, if they did that, they were going to get cut. I always thought it was a little bit of that with this Cobb and Speaker thing where it was like, we can't do this. We can't have Ty Cobb and Tris Speaker on the banned list. And so I think Landis kind of had to come down on one, you know, Ben Johnson in a lot of ways tried to find a middle ground, right? Mm-hmm. He tried to say, okay, you gambled. We don't want you here. Quietly retire. We'll let you keep your legacy. Landis, once this became public, I think had to either exonerate them or ban them because he couldn't be seen as saying, well, they did it, but it's okay and blah, blah, blah. So I think that he kind of was faced with choices. And I think that you mentioned the box score, you know, the stats the guys put up, you know, some of the questions about Dutch Leonard, all of these things. I think he found enough plausible evidence to come to the conclusion that it was in his best interest to come to. That's always been my view of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that's basically right. And the media for the most part kind of dropped it at that point. Cause I think in today's world with the way journalists investigate questionable activities and all that story might have lasted longer because of the fact of the letters. Because the letters make it very clear that there was betting on that game and that it was a lot of money bet if you didn't know who was going to win. So Landis didn't really address that so much. And I think Landis is kind of given an out because, as we're saying, the box score indicated that neither Cobb nor Speaker did anything to affect the outcome of the game other than the way it would have come out anyway. As opposed to the Black Sox, we had eight players conspiring together.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, anyway, we want to get to Black baseball and into the World Series here. So, but I just, I think there's also sort of a weird philosophical question. It's like, when does a game become thrown and when is it not, you know? And again, maybe just, you know, just to kind of, you know, bring it into modern parlance, you know, when a team sits all its players on the last day of the season in any sport, you know, like the Kansas City Chiefs did it last year on the last season, you know, or back in the old days of genuine pennant races in baseball, you know, teams would clinch the pennant. And then for the next 6 or 7 days, they would just play, you know, the guys at the end of the 40-man roster.
Right.
Once it's been established that that's going to happen, you know, that they're probably going to lose that game, not because they're not trying. Not because they're trying to lose, but because they're not particularly trying to win. So it's like, right. at what point do you say, and again, you know, once you introduce gambling, and, you know, Andrew and I think are of a similar mind about the dangers of introducing gambling so heavily into sports as is happening right now. But once you normalize gambling, it's a short step from there to, well, we already know what the outcome of this game is going to be, so let's bet on it. That's a little different than throwing, but it's a really weird, you know. So anyway, you have a couple chapters about the Black baseball and the Negro Leagues in this book. So maybe just tell us a little bit about including that, some of the major players, and, you know, how things went in Black baseball in 1926.
Yeah. Well, my experience, just to back up a little bit, my experience in writing about 1932, that season, I thought about including the Negro League, some section of that book about the Negro Leagues, and just decided not to. I couldn't really fit it into the narrative. But in 1926, Rube Foster, who was really the architect of the Negro Leagues and really a very important person in baseball history, that was the year he left the game. 6 years after he had put together the Colored World Series. So I thought that year, 1926, I couldn't write about that without noting that there was this parallel universe of Black baseball that was really at a pivot point in its history also. And of course, since 1926 is the first professional year for Satchel Paige, I also had Satchel Paige as a player and as a personality who represented Black baseball into the 30s and 40s. So it just seemed to me to fit that I needed to include some backstory on Black baseball, the story of Rube Foster, which is one chapter, and then to devote a whole chapter to the Colored World Series of 1926, which was supposed to be a best of nine and wound up requiring 11 games because 2 games were tied and had to be called because of darkness. And although Rube Foster very dramatically and sadly left the game in 1926, he suffered a mental breakdown. It was his younger half-brother, Willie Foster, who was the hero of the 1926 Colored World Series, pitching a shutout in the final game in which the winning run was scored in the bottom of the ninth inning. So there's this really dramatic Colored World Series of 1926 that really deserves a book of its own. I mean, there's enough material. It was the first postseason no hitter was pitched in game three, I believe, of that series. So there was just a lot of baseball history that I wanted to include since I was writing about the year 1926. And I think that it at least introduces readers to how vibrant the Negro Leagues were in that era.
And it seems like that's kind of the beginning of, you know, a lot of times when people talk about the Negro Leagues, it's really the 30s through the beginning, you know, the beginning of World War II. We did an episode on 1920 a few years ago, the whole year, but, you know, also a big part of it was the foundation of the Negro National League. And, you know, with each year, it gets closer and closer to what you would recognize as like an organized league. And, you know, this classic sort of World Series, 11 games, like you mentioned, and they play in a bunch of different cities, is kind of you could use to mine. Sadly, it's the end of the Rube Foster era, but it's kind of the beginning of that 15 or 18 year period that's really considered the golden age of the Negro Leagues.
Right. It begins as the golden age, and then you have the Depression, which really wrecked baseball and the Negro Leagues for a number of years. And then you've got World War II, and then finally you've got integration.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And you've got, you talk about the World Series, but to me, almost more exciting than the Negro League World Series was the pennant playoff for the Negro National League between the Chicago Americans and Chicago American Giants and the Kansas City Monarchs. When you've got two pitchers, two future Hall of Fame pitchers, it's Bill Foster, who's Rube's brother. So I'm confusing. It is Bill Foster. I'm sorry. There's a Willie Foster, an offensive Willie Foster that's mentioned on the next line. That's why I'm confusing myself. Anyway, you got Big Bill. It is Willie Foster as the pitcher. And then
he's known both as Willie and Bill.
Oh, so it's the same guy.
It's the same guy.
It is the same guy. Okay, I tripped all over myself. Anyway,
that's okay.
I shouldn't have doubted myself. Two future Hall of Fame. Everything I was saying was correct. Two future Hall of Fame pitchers, Willie Foster / Big Bill Foster for Chicago, who is Rube Foster's brother, and Bullet Rogan for Kansas City. They have a pitcher's duel that goes nine innings. The two teams decide to play a one-game playoff to determine the series, because the series is tied after the first game. They play the same day. They agree to play a five-inning game. Foster agrees to pitch the second game. And so then when Rogan sees Foster warming up, he agrees to pitch too. So these two future Hall of Famers pitch against each other twice in the same day in games that count. These aren't exhibitions. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that's the only time that's ever happened in baseball history.
Yeah, and it's part of the great history of the Negro Leagues, you know, that was just such a unique league. I mean, there's so many. I mean, you go back even before the leagues were formed, back into the teens in the early 1900s, such incredible personalities and competitions, not only during the regular season, but then the barnstorming they did after the seasons ended, and then the play like in the California Winter League, where black and white players played against each other 30 years before the major leagues were integrated.
And some of the guys like the Pages and, you know, the Gibsons are maybe just getting started in 26, but you do have a real litany of a future Hall of Famers here. You know, we talked about Rogan and Williams, but, you know, the Cristobal Torriente and Cool Papa Bell and Turkey Stearns, who was one of Turkey Stearns is probably, at least for an outfielder, a position player, I should say, maybe the most underrated Negro League player, because he was just a hell of an offensive player.
Yeah.
All right. Maybe we should bring it in for landing, Ange. What do you think?
Yeah. And I mean, I don't think we need to go game by game in the World Series. We don't want to spoil it for anybody. But, I'll take issue with the ending. I wish you would have changed the ending and which team won as a Yankee fan. But it's sort of one of the great early World Series, and early meaning the first 25 or 30 years, the 1926 World Series, and what ends up with Grover Cleveland Alexander being the hero of the series, and Babe Ruth being called out at second base, called out stealing to end the game and end the series. I guess just what's if there's one or two things to sort of top line the 1926 World Series, what would you offer there?
Top line. Well, I think you have to just look at the Cardinals and Hornsby. This was Hornsby's first trip to a World Series. He didn't get along with players. He didn't get along with management, but he was just a hell of a ball player. And really, I think a very underrated manager. His managerial career, when you look at his whole resume, you know, included 4 years with the St. Louis Browns, and he just didn't have good teams there. But I think my take on the series in 1926 was that the teams were actually pretty evenly matched. Good pitching on both sides. Herb Pennock pitched two terrific games. Wee Willie Schardell lost those games to Pennock, although he pitched really, really well. There's the famous game in which Ruth hit three home runs, including one that he promised to a sick kid in New Jersey. And then it all builds to a game seven, and it's a game seven in Yankee Stadium. And you've got Grover Cleveland-Alexander having won two games previously, game two and game six. By some reports, he was asleep in the bullpen when he was called on in the seventh inning of game seven to come in and pitch to Tony Lazzari with the bases loaded. And I mean, I think that's one of the great moments in baseball history. You know, you've got this rookie at the plate who's a power hitter, second in the league in RBIs, and you bring in Grover Cleveland-Alexander, who may still be hungover from celebrating the night before. And Alexander has got to get him out, or else the Yankees are going to win the series because the bases are loaded. Lazzari hits the second pitch about 350 feet, and it curves foul and then strikes out on the next pitch. And Lazzari, for the rest of his career, Lazzari was a great ball player. But for the rest of his career, he said every night in his bar, somebody would come up to him and ask him about that at bat, that single at bat in his entire career, a Hall of Famer. So
hopefully it wasn't the same guy every night, because that would be
hopefully not. Hopefully not, but who knows, you know. So, I mean, you've got that drama in the seventh inning, and then you get to the ninth inning, you're in Yankee Stadium, you know. Alexander is, you know, pitching on 0 days rest, and he's gotten the first two batters out. So he's retired seven batters in a row since he came in. And the next batter is Babe Ruth, and he walks him, pitches very carefully to him, walks him on a 3-2 count. Bob Musil comes to the plate. Lou Gehrig is on deck. Ruth takes off for second base, and Bob O'Farrell, who we haven't talked about, is really an underrated player from the Cardinals, in Cardinals history. He's the first catcher to ever win an MVP award, which was in that season, 1926. Bob O'Farrell throws him out at second base. Hornsby tags out Ruth. Hornsby always said that was the high point of his career. The most memorable moment of his career was tagging out Ruth, game seven, ninth inning, second base in Yankee Stadium. So you have the most dramatic ending possible, I suppose, other than a home run that ends a World Series. And you think about the players who are involved in that final moment. There's Ruth, the base runner. There's Hornsby at second base, who tags him out. There's Grover Cleveland-Alexander, winner of 373 games, on the mound. And Bob O'Farrell, who's the MVP for that year, as the catcher who throws him out. I mean, you just can't do... You couldn't create a game ending that's much more unique.
A few years ago, my best friend, who I went to college with, lives in St. Louis now. And I was out there and we went to a Cardinals game, and they have like a restaurant right across the street that we went to during the game. And all the placemats in that restaurant were the box score from that game seven of the Cardinals' first World Championship. So
yep.
It's still got a special place in the lore of St. Louis baseball, and I'm sure will forever.
Yeah, and I mean, St. Louis next to the Yankees have the most World Series titles. Mm-hmm.
I did want to point out one last thing that I learned from reading the book that I didn't know before. Game four is the game where Babe Ruth hits the three home runs, which that I knew. But in game five, it's a close game, and the Yankees lose 3-2, I believe it was, to 3-2 in 10 innings they win 3-2 actually in 10 innings over St. Louis. But what really cracked me up was that late in the game, Miller Huggins ordered Babe Ruth to bunt, which ever ordering Babe Ruth to bunt, let alone when he had just hit three home runs the day before. Baseball was the same in a lot of ways, but also kind of different in 1926.
Yeah, and he didn't just have him bunt once. I think it was twice. I think he bunted foul, and then they had him bunt again and bunted foul again. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, talking about taking the bat out of the hands of the best offensive player you've got in a one-run game. Yeah. So, I mean, I think you can make an argument that Hornsby actually outmanaged Huggins in that series. You know, you look at the pitching choices, and Hornsby pretty much, with the exception of the game where the Yankees scored 10 runs, the Cardinals pitching really held up well in that series. Mm-hmm. Hornsby, I think, was a much better manager than people have ever given him credit for, because he lost so many games with the St. Louis Browns.
And he was, you know, and this is probably a fitting place to end and ties into your saying, you know, talking about how he didn't really get along with anybody. Fresh off this monumental World Series victory and this great managing job, he is invited to seek employment with another club for the 1927 season. So.
Right. And he lasts only 1 year there. Then he goes to Boston and lasts 1 year there. Then he comes to the Cubs, gets him to the 29 World Series that they lose. And then he gets fired in 32.
Yeah, you talk about
and then
a guy,
back to the St. Louis Browns.
you talk about a guy who's tangentially, or not even tangentially, but just who is involved in so many things. A guy who, in the last year of his life, is a coach for the 62 Mets under Casey Stengel. So he right. saw a ton of baseball. And we talked about a ton of baseball tonight. And Tom, this was great. Andrew and I want to thank you and everybody. Baseball in the Roaring Twenties, the Yankees, the Cardinals, and the captivating 1926 season. Can't recommend it highly enough, and I hope you all check it out. Tom, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you. It's been delightful. Love talking baseball.
And we do too. And until next time, I'm Dan Newman.
And I'm Andrew Newman. Goodbye, old sports.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history. But as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know that. Can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even write an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you gotta do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.